The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 74. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. I've been super excited about this interview. He is an expert on the bond market and macro. His name is Jim Bianco. Jim, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so for my viewers who might not know your backstory, can you get us filled in on that?
Sure, and I might say that I'm a big fan of your show, so I'll do my backstory in three steps, right? I came out of Wall Street in the 1980s. I used to work for Shearson Lehman Brothers, First Boston before it was Credit Suisse. I'm originally from Chicago. In 1990, I got affiliated with a bond brokerage firm here in Chicago, which is where I'm at right now, called Arbor Research and Trading. And in 1998, I spun myself off into my own research firm called Bianco Research, still affiliated with Arbor. Most of my research tends to be more fixed income oriented and macro oriented as well, too. My audience is largely an institutional crowd. It's largely a fixed income crowd as too. The benefit I have with a firm like Arbor is that while I'm affiliated with a brokerage firm, they don't really position. So, you know, I don't have to go to them and say, hey, you know that big inventory of securities you have, it's about to go down in prices. They don't have a big inventory of securities. Okay. They don't care, as long as all they care about is, like most brokers, just volatility. Just make it go up or down. Just make it do something. So that's been very good. So it's really gotten rid of my conflict of interest as well, too. I tend to be more quantitatively oriented toward the way that we attack the markets more than anything else. I've taught myself how to program. I use a lot of sophisticated programming languages as well, too. I'm always on the hunt for data to try and come up with a lot of different charts and statistics and ways to show things. So that's my backstory in a quick second there.
Yeah, and I want to be clear, it's not just the institutional investor. I was on your website today. I watched your conference call that you had and that you recorded, and it was just absolutely amazing, but very easy to understand. You titled it the 90% conference call, and I found it absolutely fascinating. Could you go into greater detail on what it was about?
Yeah, that was the cover story of this week's Economist, the 90% economy. And what they talked about in that, and I had been talking about this for several weeks now, is let's say that we reopen the economy globally and we get back to 90% of where we were. Most Wall Street goes, great, we're back to 90%. Except let's put that into perspective. In the Great Recession in 2008, at its worst point, we were still producing 96% of the output that we produced at the high. So you only lost 4%. And that was enough to have the stock market and put a 10% unemployment rate up, create the Tea Party movement, Occupy Wall Street. The Great Depression in the 1930s, at its worst point in 1933, the output was still 75 or 74% of what it was in 1929. And that produced the Great Recession. So what I'm trying to say is, if you tell me that the economy's on its way back to 85 or 90% of what it was before the pandemic, I'm telling you we're running a Great Depression, because right, that is not going to do it. What's going to get us back is 98, 99. Actually, 102 would be the more, be better, is if we got further back than we were before. That kind of drop off is going to be where we are going to have big problems. And that's my big bugaboo with Wall Street right now. So they'll point to statistics like open tables, reservations at restaurants, or the mobility data that Apple puts out from their location services and go, ah, look, it went up. So what? Tell me when it gets back to 98%. Put it to you, let me stick with the restaurant. If I own a restaurant and I had 300 people a day come through my restaurant, what do I need? And I got my PPP loan and I still have everybody employed. Let's forget about whether or not they're getting paid more from the government to not work, but they're all still employed. I'm probably, if I had 300 people before the pandemic, I probably need 285 or 290 to basically get back to where I was. If you tell me, oh, it's all going well, you're going to get 250 or 220 people when you used to have 300.
Right.
I got to lay off half my staff.
Yeah, especially when your margins are 5%. Right.
Yeah, you know, or put it to a different way, a 90% economy is a 10% hit in revenues. And most, in especially in a levered economy like we are now with levered companies, you can't survive with a 10% hit. So right. We've got a long way to go before we get all the way back. And that's been my biggest concern, is that we need to understand how far back we have to come. And most of the statistics show we're not close to that right now.
Yeah, and also you talked about the PPP, and it's one of those things that might have a lot of unintended consequences that the government and the Fed just really aren't thinking through. And the consequences were, if you're a small business owner using the example of a restaurant, if they take out that PPP loan, they have to pay it back if they lay anybody off. So how right. does that work when you've got 50% of the volume, or even say 80% of the volume of your customers?
You know, there's another thing too, is that obviously if you take out the loan, you want to get it to be turned into a grant so you don't have to pay it back.
Right.
And that's, and the condition is you can't lay off anybody. But if you go out of business, you don't have to pay it back.
Yeah.
So instead of laying off 40% of my employees, and then I have to pay back the loan, I could close my business and then I don't have to pay the loan. So instead of 40% losing their jobs, 100% lose their jobs is what they're going to set up, this perverse incentive with the way that they've done these loans. And I think that that's largely understood, because in the second round of the PPP loans, when they put out this, the refunding of it, they thought it would last 12 days. It's been 3 weeks and they've hardly put out half the money. I think a lot of businesses understand that. If I take out this loan, it's a temporary thing to pay my workers, but then I can't lay them off if my business doesn't, I don't want to lay them off, but if my business doesn't come back, I can't adjust my workforce except close my business. And I don't right. want to do that. So yeah, it does set up a bunch of perverse incentives.
Yeah, so they don't want to take on the additional liability and having that burden on their shoulders. So that could put them more at risk of going out of business, or at least it doesn't get the money from the Fed or the government to Main Street. There's still that line in the sand that it doesn't cross. And that was the big problem, well, probably for the last 10, 12 years, is that you've got all these bank reserves being created at the Fed, and they're just only going into financial assets. They're not getting into the real economy. That seems to be always the problem.
That's right, because all the Fed can do is provide it to the banking system, provide it, and then they have to trust or make sure that the banking system turns around and redistributes the money to the parties that need it. And that was the big thing that happened in 2008. We create all these programs, and we trade all these programs to make sure that the banks are well capitalized. And the banks say, thank you very much. You gave me all this money to keep me in business. Well, go out and hand out loans. And the banks are you kidding me? Have you seen how bad the economy is? I have no interest in handing out any loans to anybody. And that bred a lot of social discontent. You know, first you had the Tea Party movement, then you had Occupy Wall Street. And I like to say that, what did they have in common? The Tea Party movement was mad about the bailouts and they blamed the government. Occupy Wall Street was mad about the bailouts and they blamed Wall Street. But both of them were mad about the same thing, is what happened. It was just who they thought was at fault for it is where they disagreed. So you see that kind of happening again now in the financial markets all over again. The Fed has put together this endless alphabet soup of programs. They are shoving money into the financial system. That money is helping to support financial prices. But whether or not it actually filters through into the real economy hasn't yet happened. Now, we're in early days. You know, most people that have lost their job are still getting $1,000 a week or thereabouts on unemployment. A lot of them have probably got a raise for being on unemployment. A lot of others have only been laid off for a couple of weeks. There's the talk in the press is about restarting. The surveys say that 85% of University of California did a survey of people that are on unemployment in the state of California. 85% said, I will get my job back once the crisis passes. So the anger's not there yet because there's still this belief, oh, this will go away and this summer I'll be back employed, or I lost my job, but I'm getting as much money in unemployment as I was working. But once this starts to filter through and it takes more time and it isn't working out like you thought, and maybe I don't get my job back, you know, once it's over, then the people start to assess who won, who lost, and where was I in that mix as well, too. So I think we got, you know, we're in early days on this thing, and we've got a ways to go.
Yeah, it's when reality replaces hope type of thing. And I know you've done extensive research on the virus, and you were one of the first people with Chris Mortensen and my buddy Eric Townsend with Macro Voices to start doing the thinking and throwing out the data. And I know you took a lot of heat on that, but I'd love to get your opinion on where we go from here.
You know, as far as the government goes with the virus, I had no problem with what they did in mid-March. Because we didn't really understand what was going on with it. But now that we're into May, we know a lot more, and we've got the Sweden example as well too. And also, I really don't like the way that they've really redefined the whole problem. In other words, it was flatten a curve. Remember right. Flatten a curve? Remember what they told us about flatten a curve? First of all, it produces the same number of cases if you flatten right. a curve just over a longer period of time. You're not saving anybody from getting sick when you flatten this curve. What you're doing by pressing it down is making sure if you get sick, there's a hospital bed and proper medical care for you. That's all we're promising with flatten the curve. We did that. It's done. So what are we waiting for? I get, you know, with my governor, J.B. Pritzker in Illinois, or with Andrew Cuomo in New York, when they talk about, or Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, saying we have to be locked down till June. What are you waiting for? What magic signal are you waiting for to tell you it's okay to open? And then they keep saying, well, we have to save lives. Well, no, you're not. You're just making it go longer. I mean, everybody's supposed to get it. Herd immunity means you're going to get sick. I'm going to get sick. My kids are going to get sick. But hopefully, slowly over time, and hopefully, and there will be proper medical care, and then we can build up herd immunity. But if the answer is we got to stay locked down till we get a vaccine or this goes away, well, it isn't going to go away unless we get a vaccine or we get herd immunity. Quick word about vaccine. Do you know in the entire history of medicine how many coronavirus vaccines we've developed? Zero. But this is supposedly going to be the first one that we're going to develop. I'm not a virologist, but I'll just say I see the track record. I know they've been trying for 50 years to put together coronavirus vaccines, and they've never done one. But yet now we're supposed to have this one done in a period of a year. It'd be great if it happens, but I'm not going to hold my breath and wait for that vaccine. So yeah, I think really what we need to do is kind of the Sweden thing. You and I and everybody watching this, we know what we need to do. Social distance, wear a mask, wash our hands. Go ahead, let us go about doing it. And the last thought for you is, I lived in New York City, and I have two kids that live in New York City. They're here with me in Chicago now, and I'm very familiar with New York City. If you're going to leave the subway system open, the perfect transmitter of a pandemic, yeah, nothing right. else that you do in New York City can be as dangerous as riding the subway system. So go get your hair cut. Go on out for dinner. It's not as bad as getting on the subway every day. Most of the reason that New York City has got such a problem is the subway system is still open. And that is the perfect enclosed environment of having people, everybody get together, breathe on each other for 10 minutes in this car, and then everybody disperse throughout the city.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
couldn't have found a better way to spread out a virus. And if you're going to allow that, then allow the restaurants to open, because it can't be worse than allowing the New York subway system to stay open.
Yeah, but even if they allow these things to open up, I mean, is it going to matter? going back to your data where it says, you know, we got to get up to 100%. I mean, maybe that allows us to go from 50% to 65 or 70. And I know for some people, it definitely would matter. But overall, I mean, does it really move the needle?
It doesn't move the needle short term, like over the near term, the next year or two. But what it does do is, this gets into my criticism of what the Fed is doing. I've argued, even all the way back to that video I did with Martinson and Townsend back in early February.
I remember that well.
There's a pre-virus era and there's a post-virus era. And that this virus is going to be the defining moment of this generation, that there was the world was, and then the world that we're going to. So we're transitioning to some new era. I don't think we are in some kind of state of pause, and then we go back to 2019. We're going somewhere else. So let's open up and let businesses start to figure out what that new era is. Let them start to get going there. So you're right. We're not going to go back to 100%. We're going to go back higher and higher and higher. We're going to come up short, and that's going to be a problem for the economy. But if you ever want to get back to some version of 100%, we need to restructure the economy. And that's not going to be waiting for the White House to tell us how it's going to be restructured. It's going to be you, me, and everybody else figuring out the new rules of the road. So let's get about figuring out the new rules of the road. And that gets me to the Fed. I've got very mixed emotions about what they've been doing on this. On the one hand, I'm a libertarian Austrian at heart. I think that government involvement is always bad, and I believe it's always bad. But also, this is unusual. And if Peter Schiff is watching, Peter, I've been wanting to ask you this question. I'll throw it out to you too, George. Maybe you can give me a feel on it. The government took a bunch of perfectly fine running businesses and said, close, stop doing your business, drove you out of your job, drove you out of your business. The takings clause of the Constitution says you can't do that without compensating me. So in some respects, I'm owed compensation because you took a perfect business and you forced it shut. This is not the free market saying that I've become obsolete or something else has changed. So I get that the heavy government involvement is kind of a payment for that shutting down those businesses. I get the heavy Fed involvement is that. And besides, I don't think they were ever going to sit back and say, wow, look at that. Everything's falling apart, but we can't do anything about it. So, you know, make some more popcorn and let's watch this thing unfold. They had to step into it. But my complaint comes in is, what is it you're trying to do? And what it seems that they're trying to do is they're trying to say, we want to bridge us to when we can go back to 2019. Well, right. We're not going back to 2019. Right. If you want to say to people, look, you lost your job. It's a new era. Here's some short-term assistance to help you because it came on so fast. And then we could say, but at some point, we got to start the process of adjusting, because the longer we try to hold everything in suspended animation, the longer it's going to take us to get past this. So we need this adjustment process to go on. When you hear companies like Twitter saying that, which they announced yesterday, everybody can work at home now forever. And a lot more companies are saying you can work at home now forever. A lot of big businesses in New York City, Jess Staley, who's the CEO of Barclays Bank, they got a big 50-story office tower in Midtown with a couple of thousand employees in it. And they're now understanding, and this applies for all the Midtown Manhattan office buildings, the new social distancing rules are 2 people to an elevator. That's never going to work with a 60-story office building. And so what Jess Staley said is, our employees may never go back to that building, never go back to that building. That alone should tell you what an epic change is coming. And I want to use the word change. Yeah, it's going to be struggle in the beginning, but then we're going to change and we're going to come out of it. I do believe in human ingenuity, and I do believe we'll get past this if we allow the ingenuity to get past it. But if we keep throwing money at everybody and saying, no, don't change anything, stay that way, sit there and don't do anything, here's $1,000 a week, don't move, don't look for a job, then we're never going to get past this. And that's what my biggest concern is.
Yeah. How do you combine that with the fact that, just to your last point there, the government is basically paying people to stay home. So you have all these employers that are competing now with the government for the, these employees to produce goods and services.
That's a problem. It's a problem on two levels. One, if you look at Google search trends, you know what's not surging on Google search trends? In fact, I just tweeted it out from my colleagues at Arbor Data Science. People searching for a job. One is searching for a job on Google search trends.
Wow.
Now, part of that is that they probably conclude, probably rationally, now's not the time to be looking for a job because the economy's so bad. But I think part of that also is, I'm getting paid $1,000 a week to not find a job. Why should I be busting my balls to go out there and find a job? And they're not. And that's going to be a real problem as we move forward from here. We need to restructure the economy. And restructuring the economy is not endless money printing and endless government bailouts of everybody. I get it. You got to get it for right now. It came on everybody fast. I get it. 40% of the public doesn't have $1,000 of savings. And most of those people, they got hit more with losing their jobs. You just don't want to cut them loose. I understand that. But that doesn't mean that they become a permanent ward of the state. Some point, we're going to have to end this. And some point, we're going to have to start the restructuring process. And it ain't going to be pretty. But I do know, I do believe that if you let it happen, it will happen fast in a period of a year, maybe 18 months would be my guess. But if you want to do like 2008 and string this out for 3, 4, 5 years, because you just keep doing money printing, quantitative easing, government programs, that's when it's going to be, I think, more painful in the long term.
You know, the hard thing for me to reconcile is going back to the Austrian school. If you look at a recession, it's really considered the cure for all of the malinvestment and all the misallocation of resources, the excessive debt, etc. And I look at it like going to the gym. So if you go to the gym, it's not easy. It sucks. It's hard work. It's very difficult, but it makes you stronger, just like that recession makes the economy stronger. So if you can argue back in 2008 that we should have gone through a deeper recession to clean out the system, we tried to kick the can down the road, and that made the entire system more fragile to where we are today. How do you reconcile that view with the correct policy response in 2020?
That's a good question. It's a tough one, but you're right. We do need to kind of clean out the system. Let's go back to 2008. Remember we used to call QE unconventional policy?
Yeah,
now
exactly.
In 2020, the conventional part of it is the standard QE. The unconventional part of it is buying ETFs and corporate bonds. We keep this mission creep going and going. But what is the effect of all of that is the zombie companies that have been out there. A zombie company is basically a company that has more interest payments than earnings. That's like 15% of the companies out there right now. But we keep them afloat because we force interest rates down lower and lower, and in the case of Europe, negative, to kind of keep these companies going as well, too. If you don't allow companies to bend and fold and shape and maybe fail and reborn, you're never going to get yourself a truly healthy system. I'll give you an example. We bailed out the auto industry in 2008. The auto industry in 2008 was failing largely because it needed to radically change.
It needed to fail. It needed to restructure, right?
Right. And see, the problem is most people think that when you say the auto companies need to go bankrupt, they confuse that word with liquidation.
Right.
No, we're not going to liquidate them, and there's going to be a half-done car on an assembly line with weeds growing through the floor. We're still going to make cars. We're just going to make them in a different way. So by not allowing the auto industry to come and restructure, you give rise to a company like Tesla, which winds up becoming out of control bubble because it's competing with a bunch of zombies that could never make Tesla honest.
Right.
Tesla could never be made honest because the auto companies that they're competing with can never really are allowed to change. They still have to deal with all the legacies that they had. because you never allowed that to change. We need companies to change. We need them to bend and fold. As much as it's terrible for taxi drivers, the Ubers of the world are a good thing in the long run. They also tend to be net producers of jobs. I understand, but you make more as a taxi driver than you do as an Uber driver. Yeah, but there's 10,000 taxi drivers and there's 65,000 Uber drivers in New York City, at least pre-virus there was. And so it gives more opportunity for jobs. So we need to get about doing this. And when the Fed comes in with their programs and when the Fed starts doing this, they are promoting a status quo. When we need the Schumpeter creative destruction to be happening at this point. And by promoting a status quo, and I understand, I want to emphasize again, yeah, I get it. You weren't supposed to take a bunch of people that made less than $40,000 a year and say, you're fine in February, you're done in March. It's hard. It's real hard to put that on them. So I get it. We need to help them a little bit along the way, but we need to get about going about this change. And every time I hear President Trump say, oh, we're going to boom like we never boomed before on the other side, what he's saying is we're going to go right back to 2019. I'd like to think that. It's just that when companies are being told that you never have to go back to the office again, for starters, it's already different. And it's not going to be 2019 under any circumstance.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the early 1980s when our debt to GDP was 30% and the market cap to GDP was maybe 40-45%, calling it the Buffett indicator. I think that would be far more healthy, but that's just my opinion. Hey, can we discuss the CNBC interview that you tweeted the other day? I think you were on yesterday or the day prior, and I thought it was really interesting when you were talking about the Fed funds futures going into negative territory.
Yeah,
and then also Japan too. I'm sorry, in that CNBC interview, you talked about Japan. I'd love to discuss that as well.
Yeah, so Fed fund futures are, you know, just a way for the market to express an opinion about where the Fed funds rate is going to be in the future. And by early next year, you're starting to see some numbers come up. Now, they're small, so they're starting to lean towards the idea that the Fed might go to negative interest rates. But again, the odds are very small, but I still think it's significant that we've crossed the Rubicon and that traders are willing to go and trade them into negative territory as well. So what does it mean if the Fed was to go to negative interest rates? That means the bank pays you. The financial system, bottom line it for you, the financial system was never built for negative interest rates. You can build a financial system for negative interest rates, just not the one we have right now. And that the banking system, the financial markets, the plumbing of the financial markets simply will not work properly with a negative rate. Now, we've had them in Europe and we've had them in Japan. And people say, but it did kind of function. Yeah, kind of dysfunctionally through the European financial system and the Japanese financial system, but they had a big out. The reserve currency of the United States was always positive.
Exactly.
Now, if you push us into that territory too, then you wind up pushing us into that negative system. Now, President Trump tweeted earlier this week, he called the negative rates a big gift. Sure, any levered real estate guy would think negative interest rates. You mean you're going to give me a boatload of money to build a building that no one needs, and then every month you're going to give me more money? That's what negative rates means? What a great idea. Sure, but the lender, the financial institution that's supposed to give you that money, they're going to go out of business. Now, maybe you think they're a bunch of banksters, and I'm not going to disagree with you that a bunch of them are, but it doesn't help us to wind up having the entire financial system crash and burn all around us because of negative interest rates. In Japan, where they went to negative interest rates, and here's the problem when you start pushing into negative interest rates. That's kind of an unnatural act. Markets, you know, we've had interest rates for 5,000 years. Sidney Homer wrote a book that actually tracked interest rates back to 3000 BC. Mm. In fact, I've got that book somewhere in my office here. I'll find it later. But it's 700 pages in that book. There's nowhere in there is negative interest rates before 2014. And what that means is that a negative interest rate is kind of a government-directed thing. And when you start directing markets, where the government starts setting the rate in markets, you wind up what happened in Japan. And that is, the day that the Fed, the day that the Bank of Japan goes to QQE, qualitative quantitative easing, they said, okay, we're going to try and target the 10-year yield at zero. Okay, I'll be generous. The day you did it, that was probably close to the proper value. 4 years later, you're still targeting the same number. You never changed it. I think you've got the wrong level. You've chased the private sector out of the Japanese government bond market.
Right.
There are whole days where benchmark issues in Japan don't trade. It barely trades 10% of what it traded 10 years ago right now. Volume shrivels up and goes away. If the government's going to set the price, eventually, that even if you admit that the day they set it, it's the right price, eventually it will be the wrong price. And when it's the wrong price, people are not going to be interested in transacting in that market. Oh, yeah, there'll be sellers that think the price is too high or buyers that think the price is too low that want to do a trade, but no one will be on the other side of that trade. And that, therefore, the volume disappears and it goes away. This is the mistake that they make. The whole reason we have markets in price discovery is we don't know what the true value is. It's not a math equation. It's not an equation a bunch of bureaucrats in Washington can divine. It's the wisdom of the crowd, and we forever seek the proper level, and then we change our mind, and we seek it again, and we change our mind, and we seek it again. That's how markets allow us to be efficient. Never be that way. The government is going to be running the show, like we are dangerously getting close to right now.
It's above my pay grade, but what's going through my head right now that I'd love to get your opinion on is, if you had a situation in the United States where the U.S. Treasury market traded or didn't trade like the JGB market, how does that work with the U.S. dollar funding markets, more specifically the repo market? I mean, it seems like it would just blow up.
It would, because, you know, keep in mind that there is something like $800 billion of currency in the world, the actual physical bills.
Right.
But the amount of cash, or the things that we think of as cash, is many, many times that. So what we do is we use the government bond market, the treasury bill market, and the like, as a cash substitute. So that anytime a big company needs to send another big company $1 billion, they don't send them a pallet full of dollar bills.
Right.
They wire them treasury securities. So we use them as cash substitutes. And as long as there is a vibrant liquid market, we could create derivatives off that market, like repurchase agreements and the like. When the volume of those was to shrivel up and go away, and the only reason that that would happen is if by government fiat we set the wrong price, those markets would become dysfunctional. You would either be perceived as, like I said, the price is too high and I want to buy it, but nobody wants to sell it to me, or the price is too low and I want to sell it, but nobody wants to buy it. But in a free market, the price should always be somewhere near equilibrium so that I can attract buyers and attract sellers and transact at some point. If you don't have that, the plumbing of the financial system, the ability of large institutions like financial institutions to send cash back and forth to each other, to balance their books, starts to become a problem. Our financial system is not structured that way. It won't work properly if we wind up having the markets go in that direction. Now, let me say, well, a lot of people at the Fed, if they're listening to this, they'll say, yeah, but we're doing this in an emergency. And then when the emergency passes, we'll back off. Jim, I agree with you that if we did this too much, it would become problematic.
Yeah, that's QE1 right there.
Right, QE1. We're in year 13 of QE1 that morphed into 2, 3, 4 and everything else. It never went away. Furthermore, let me give you another sobering statistic, since I'm Johnny Raincloud on this interview here. Larry Kudlow said that to date, the total amount of Fed printing and borrowings from the, or promised borrowings from the government, is $9 trillion. Earlier this week, the Democrats put up a bill for another $3 trillion. That's $12 trillion. Let me put that number in a different perspective. That is approaching 4.5 years of income tax receipts. So in the space of 2 months, we said, here's the problem. We're going to just whip up 4.5 years of income tax receipts to solve this problem. We're either going to print it or we're going to borrow against it. Now, if you are an optimist, a government optimist, we're going to do this. We're going to support the markets. We're going to support everybody with a job. We're not going to produce inflation. We're not going to produce malinvestment. Let's just suspend reality and think you're not going to produce inflation and or malinvestment. Why would you stop? Why would you stop after the problem is over? This is MMT, Modern Monetary Theory 1.0 is what this is. So if you do it and there isn't a toxic reaction in bad malinvestment or a plunging dollar or rising inflation, which
why are we going to work, Jim? Why? Why on earth is anyone working?
Well, that was what I was going to lead up to.
Just print the money, give it to everyone. If there's no negative consequence to money printing, what are we doing working? We're just a bunch of saps.
Right. Or what I was going to lead up to is, why are we even paying taxes anymore?
Yeah.
Because if you can print up a year's worth of taxes, you know, our taxes are not due until July 15th. And there's already stories I'm reading that they may push that off until December 31st. That in Chicago, my real estate tax bill, they just passed, which is normally due in the first week of August. They said, now I could pay it October 1st. You know, you start pushing this stuff off, it's going to be hard to turn it back on after a while, because unless there is a bad reaction, look, you didn't pay your taxes and look at how bad things got, because we kind of need the money for the system to work properly. Okay, well, then I guess I have my obligation to pay taxes. But if you tell me I don't have to pay my taxes and the stock market keeps going up and everybody gets their job back and there's no problem, you're going to completely pervert the system. So what I'd like to say is that this government expansion, no matter how well-meaning it is, will continue to expand and expand until it becomes a problem. So when my friends at the Fed say, oh, well, we're going to do this with the government bond market, we're going to do this with ETFs, that's not going to be a problem for the market. Yeah, and it will be a pleasurable experience if you're right, and the demand will be not for you to stop doing it, but to do more of it. And if that's a pleasurable experience, you'll do more of it until you've gone too far. So we eventually will. Like you said, QE1 became 2, 3, which never went away. Now we're buying corporate bonds. We're buying ETFs. We're going to buy municipal securities. I don't know how these programs ever go away.
Right.
I don't know if they ever will go away. And that's going to be a big problem as we move forward.
What I'm thinking through in my mind here, and let me try to articulate this as well as I can. So we've got all of this money printing going into, let's call it in the form of MMT or helicopter money, going to people. They like this. They want it to continue. Then at the same time, we have all these programs that are being set up where there's more bank reserves. And who knows if those are becoming deposits in the retail banking system, therefore increasing M2. And if we're getting helicopter money into at the average Joe and Jane, that most likely will increase velocity. And then you've got the Fed trying to peg the yield curve because they don't want interest rates to go up, because we know that if the 10-year goes up, let's say to 3-4%, then that almost has the same impact as the virus. You know, that's extremely damaging when you build an economy that gets addicted to 0% interest rates. But in order to do that, the Fed has to buy treasuries. So they have to become a bigger part of the market. Then you reduce liquidity in the treasury market, going back to the Bank of Japan. And if the Fed has to continue to buy to control the yield curve, is there a point where the Fed can't buy any more treasuries because the dollar funding markets need collateral, so they paint themselves into a corner and inflation takes off because you have all this increase in M2 and velocity because of the helicopter money?
Sure. We saw it last September with the repo market. You know, what happened with the repo market is, in simply put, 2008, we have a financial crisis. One of the problems with the financial crisis was the banks overlevered. They went too far, most famously Lehman Brothers. And then so for the last 12 years, we've been putting governors on the banks. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't lever. And what's important to understand about that is it wasn't just the Fed that did it. It was everybody that did it. It was the European Banking Commission. It was the OCC, the Office of Comptroller of Currency. It was the Fed. It was the FDIC. It was the Treasury Department. You know, it, on and on and on. So we kept limiting the banks to what they could do.
Just to be clear to the viewer, you're talking about Dodd-Frank, the G-SIB, and like Basel III, those types
yes,
of regulations?
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. G-SIB, the globally systemic important banks, Dodd-Frank. What I'm trying to tell the viewer is it wasn't just the Fed that put together these rules. It was all kind of regulators that put together these rules. And we want to limit the banks, limit the banks, limit the banks. But what were we also doing for the last 12 years? Borrowing more, borrowing more, borrowing more. So the Treasury market kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but we kept putting limits on the banks. And then it broke in September because the ability of the banks to expand to meet the ever-expanding Treasury market and the ever-expanding repo market, they couldn't handle it anymore. And then the market broke. And then when the bankers came in and said to the Fed, too many rules, you want us to expand our balance sheets to meet these larger needs for borrowing, we can't do it. And the Fed said, okay, well, we'll suspend our rules. And they said, no, it's not just your rules, it's everybody's rules. And you don't have the ability to suspend everybody's rules. So that's when they came in with all these repo operations and everything else to try and artificially expand the market. All I'm trying to say is we have an example of that happening. It happened last year. So as the market continues to go, we were going to continue to have these problems. The Fed will continue to try and push money into the system to try and meet these ever-expanding problems. To that end, I've been one that's been very worried that on the back end of this, we're going to have a problem with interest rates going up and maybe going up in a big way. What I mean by the back end, yes, I understand in the second quarter and the third quarter, we're going to have contracting GDP. We're going to have the economy going down. We're going to have maybe deflation happening in the immediate quarters, maybe a year ahead. But at the other side of that, we've got two things going on at once. One, we've got a massive amount of borrowing going on right now. I started in the bond market when I told you I worked in the beginning. I worked at, First Boston and Shearson Lehman Brothers. That was 1987 when I started. I was there around the stock market crash. That was 33 wow. years ago. And for 33 years, people have, I was a young guy then when I started then. 33 years ago, when people said, used to tell me almost from day one, there's going to be a crowding out. The government's going to borrow so much money, they're going to push up interest rates. And for 33 years, I kept saying, that's not a thing. And it wasn't a thing. Well, welcome to the post-virus world. Now it actually might be a thing because the amount of borrowing that the government is going to do now, these are numbers that are hard to understand. In January, when the Treasury comes out and says, here's our borrowing needs for the first quarter, $360 billion. Everybody said, holy crap, $360 billion. I thought it would be $340 billion. And you put $360 billion of borrowing? And then the second quarter numbers come out, $3 trillion. Wait a minute, how am I supposed to process that number if I thought 360 was a big number over 340? Now we're at $3 trillion. So the amount of borrowing that is going to come down the pike is going to really stress the financial system, I think. And that can be problematic. One of the reasons I've talked about this repeatedly, since March 13th, when the Fed formally restarted QE, they have bought $2 trillion with a T dollars of securities, another number no one understands. They bought $2 trillion worth of bonds since March 13th. March 16th, the 10-year Treasury was 72 basis points. Tuesday, it was 72 basis points. And I said, if this market was anywhere near normal, and you said, here's a normal market, and the government prints up $2 trillion and buys bonds, where would the yield be? Zero, if not negative. You would have had the biggest rally you've ever seen. Why didn't we have that rally? Because away from the Fed, everybody's liquidating. And the reason everybody's liquidating is they see this massive deficit coming. And I think that on the backside, they see inflation. If inflation is the intersection of aggregate demand and aggregate supply, What do I see coming on the other side of this? Aggregate supply is going to go down. If we're going to have 20% unemployment, we're not going to be making as much stuff
exactly
as we used to make.
Like everyone misses the supply side of the equation. Right. Everyone. They just focus on demand.
Supply is going to go down. Everything is going to be less of everything. Aggregate demand. If we keep giving everybody $1,000 a week, you're going to keep wanting to buy stuff. That's going to give us inflation on the other side. We're going to keep that market out of balance. So the fear of way too much supply and inflation, I think, is really pushing up interest rates. Because like I said, incredibly, I think if this market was anywhere near normal right now, interest rates would just be plunging and plunging. They'd be where the German 10-year Bund is at minus 50 basis points. Or they'd be where the Japanese 10-year is, somewhere below zero. They wouldn't be stalled at 60 or 70 basis points like they have been for 2 months. So I already see those problems manifesting themselves. But I understand, I work on Wall Street, and I know how problems work on Wall Street. You identify a problem, and people look at their watch and go, well, it's been 8, 9, 10 seconds, and it hasn't blown up, so I guess you're wrong. And that's kind of the way everybody works with this stuff until it then becomes a problem, and they go, oh, I guess it really was a problem after all. People get very impatient when you tell them that there's a problem. But I still think that this market is not really behaving properly, given what is happening to it and the lack of what's going. In fact, maybe one step further, I think we already have yield curve control. I think that it's a de facto yield curve control. Every week, the Fed adjusts the amount of buying that they do. Yield curve control, let me give you a definition of that. The Japanese modernized it in 2016. They said, we're going to peg the 10-year yield at zero, a zero yield. We will buy or sell as much as necessary every week to make sure that the yield is at zero. That's yield curve control. And the problem, like I said, is, well, maybe the week you did it, it was fine to be zero. But if you do that every week, if you're saying that the proper interest rate every week for 4 years is zero, eventually it's not going to be. And that's when volume disappears and everybody just leaves the market. I think for the last couple of weeks, for the last 2 months or so, we've got a de facto yield curve control in the U.S. We seem to be between 60 and 70 basis points on the 10-year yield. It doesn't go anywhere. Its volatility measures are plunging. The volatility measures in the stock market and commodity markets and FX markets are not plunging. And so there's a big disconnect between what's happening with the bond market and what's happening with everything else. But I'm pointing out a disconnect of a lack of volatility. So everybody goes, well, it can't be that important because it's a lack of volatility disconnect. But it is. It's a signal that it's telling us that the market is not right.
Yeah, and the lack of volatility is potentially a signal telling us that the Fed is getting a lot closer to the BOJ, meaning that they're a lot bigger portion of the market, and it's just not trading like a healthy market would.
Right. I mean, they really are. Ken Rogoff came out today. He's a Harvard professor, and he's a big, let's call him an influencer in Fed circles. He's right. Got a paper out that the Fed should be putting the funds rate at -3 right now. He's not on the Fed, but they take him very seriously as well. So this idea is still Nariel Nashikoloda, who's the former Minneapolis Fed president. He's publicly called for negative interest rates as well, too. So these distortions are out there. These markets aren't working right. And the more that I think they call for that, the more that they encourage the private sector to leave. The only reason the market is not going up in yield is it's the Fed is buying, but it's taking $2 trillion of buying just to hold interest rates steady. That sounds like the path of Japan. The private sector leading, the public sector is taking over the market. Eventually, if you have that loss of a capitalist market to seek equilibrium, you're going to get malinvestment. And look at the Japanese economy. What is it? Yep. What is the one constant in the Japanese economy? Lousy growth. It can't ever seem to get out of its own way. And that's what I'm really afraid of, that the Fed needs to get out of this. But the only way I see them getting out is a toxic reaction to what they've been doing that burns their fingers and says, all right, you got to leave. I'm afraid that the stock market keeps going up, everything keeps holding together, and the encouragement of, yes, Jay Powell, you're our savior. Please do more of this and please do more of this. And they'll credibly tell me, but what they've done is not been over the top. Yeah, well, we'll do more of it. We'll eventually get there then. We'll just keep expanding this thing until we do go too far.
Yeah, so how does that end game work? I mean, and the rebuttal, I think, Jim, would that people would say, okay, you're talking about Japan. They have low growth. They haven't seen a lot of inflation. So why can't we just send everyone $1 million and we don't ever have to worry about inflation? Because look what happened in the United States since 2008. And look what's happened in Japan. This inflation boogeyman is something that we just shouldn't be worried about. So why not just start UBI? Why not send everyone $1 million and into their checking account? We can all live happily ever after.
We're going to do that. That's exactly the road we're going down. We already sent everybody a $1,200 check. We're already giving them more money than they probably made. Not everybody. More money than they've probably made. Through unemployment insurance. We already have UBI being proposed in the Democrats' latest bill right now. A version of that is coming along as well, too. But you're right. See, the problem is that's MMT. MMT, modern monetary theory, is, if I was to boil it down to a few sentences, is we will print the money for everything we need. We will do away with taxes, except when we get inflation. Then we bring back taxes as a way to drain money. So I like to say, in the current system we have, the Fed sets the funds rate. So interest rates go up and down to kind of regulate regulate inflation. In the MMT system, interest rates are set at zero. Tax rates go up and down to kind of regulate inflation as well, too. So you're right. What will happen is, and that's why I'm saying we're going to MMT. We're already telling you don't have to pay your taxes. You don't have to, we don't have to pay them to July, maybe December. I don't have to pay my real estate taxes until later this year as well, too. We're going to print this money. We're going to hand it to everybody. The end game has to be inflation, and it will be inflation, because if we do this and we don't produce inflation, we're not going to stop. We'll just do more of it. We'll hand everybody $2 million. Right. And if that doesn't produce inflation, we'll hand everybody $4 million. And we'll just keep going until it winds up going too far. There is no way that we're going to say, okay, we did all these extraordinary actions, we fixed the market, now we're going to withdraw the troops back to the barracks. I'm all full of metaphors today. We're going to bring them all back and we're going to stop doing it. Nope. Especially if Biden is president. If Biden is president, then he's already put AOC on his advisory committee as well. The idea that we need to have free health care, free college education, and we're just going to print the money to pay for it all or borrow the money to pay for it all will be unstoppable, because we just printed and borrowed 5 years of tax returns in 2 months. If this winds up not being a bad outcome, then we're going to wind up printing another 5 years worth and another 5 years worth until we go too far. The sooner we have a toxic reaction, the smaller it'll be. The longer we play this game, the larger it would be. I told you I was Johnny Raincloud on this.
Yeah, game. But the problem there, Jim, is that if we get this type of inflation, let's say it ticks up to 5-6%, or something like we had in the 1970s, the Fed can't come in Volcker style and take rates up to 18%, because the economy would just be crushed because of the amount of debt. In fact, I think Eric said that he heard a quote from Volcker before he passed away. Someone asked him if we could do today, and this was back in 2019, what he did in the early 80s, and he said, absolutely not. He said, no chance. There's just too much debt.
I agree. There is way too much debt, and there's this undying belief in the Fed. We're borrowing $3 trillion worth of treasuries. Why didn't the treasury market buckle under that idea? Because the Fed's here, and the Fed will print money, and the Fed can make everything, fix all of the ills in the marketplace. So there's this undying belief that the Fed can handle whatever problems we need, that they can regulate interest rates. What happens if interest rates start up because there's too much borrowing or inflation? The Fed will suppress them back down. And that's kind of a counterintuitive thing as well, too. So there's that belief in the marketplace right now that we could fix it. Look, that's what lifted us off the lows in late March. You know, the Fed came in with a bunch of kitchen sinks they threw at the market in late March, and we've got this rally going. If you ask anybody on Wall Street, why did the market rally since the late March? The first reason they will give you most likely is because the Federal Reserve stepped in with its printing press. So there's this undying belief that the Fed can handle all of these problems. So you're right. We're not worried about rising interest rates. We're not worried about inflation because we think the Fed can fix that. And it will only take a shaking of that confidence in central banking or central planning that is going to create some kind of a change in the attitude right now. But right now, you know, everything's okay, not because the data size is okay, not because we're going to have a 98% economy. We might even have an 85% economy because the printing press is here and the printing press is going to fix everything.
Yeah, it's just inflation is the kryptonite. Because inflation takes away the printing press. So I want to be cognizant of your time, Jim.
I got some time.
I appreciate you being so generous today. But one question I want to make sure I ask you, because I think it applies to the majority of the people that are watching this video. I noticed, I think it was in your 90-minute or your 90% presentation conference call you did yesterday, but you talked about the risk parity portfolio, this typical 401k setup that every financial advisor out there suggests of this 60-40. And you had these charts showing that this relationship between bonds and stocks most likely has changed. And if it hasn't changed now, it may change in the future, but it's not, they're not tied at the hip like all these financial advisors and all these baby boomers out there that probably have their portfolio set up this way actually think. So could you walk us through that? Because I think that's a very powerful warning for a lot of people.
The most basic relationship in finance is interest rates versus risk markets, the stock market versus the bond market. When interest rates go up or down, how do the risk markets respond to that? And I've argued that the driving factor in this, not only me, but others that have looked at this have come to a similar conclusion, is inflation. So go back to the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s. That I would call the inflation mindset period. Mindset. We're always worried about inflation. So why do interest rates go up in the 70s, 80s, or 90s? Because there's a fear of rising inflation.
Right.
What does that do for risk markets? It depresses them. When you're relieved, oh, look, there's no inflation. Rates go down and stock market go up. So interest rates and risk markets like stocks move opposite each other. You get to the late 90s around long-term capital, the Russian debt moratorium, the Asian financial crisis, and we have a sea change view ending with the tech bubble in 2000. Now deflation is the biggest concern and has been for 20 years. Why do interest rates go up? It is a relief of no deflation. That's good for stocks because deflation's bad for them. Why do interest rates plummet? It is a fear of deflation. So when interest rates go down, stocks struggle as well too. So they move together with each other. I've been arguing that starting about a year ago on the edges, but really since the virus hit, that relationship has gone away. There is no relationship now between stocks and interest rates. They seem to be random, or they're transitioning from one version to the other. Look, when you go from the inflation mindset to the deflation mindset, it isn't one day you flip the switch. I argued it took 4 years that the stock bond relationship was random for 4 years. They seemed to relate, then they didn't relate, then they related. So we've gone random. So what does that mean short term? Your 60-40 portfolio. This is the driving thing that every wealth manager has. There are 36 million accounts in the United States that their money is being directed by a wealth manager. Why do you go to a wealth manager? Because you're afraid. You're probably in your 50s. You've probably seen 2000, 2008. And this is even before the virus.
Right.
You saw a 50% correction twice. You say, I'm afraid. I want to be invested, but I'm afraid. Because if you weren't afraid, you'd just go out and you'd buy double levered S&Ps and you'd be done. But so you're afraid. And so the answer that every wealth manager had for you was the 60-40 portfolio. 60% of your money in stocks, 40% of your money in bonds. Because the stock market goes up, you get the appreciation. But when the stock market wobbles, the bond market rallies big. And that provides you with a natural hedge. And it worked great until around the fourth quarter of 18 and in 19, and especially fell down during the sell-off in February and March, because the stock market tanked and interest rates didn't do a whole lot to help offset that pain. So what I've argued is, one, the 60-40 portfolio is now two random investments. They're not related to each other anymore. Sometimes both might go up. Sometimes they both might go down. Sometimes one will go up and one will go down as well. So that's going to cause a lot of consternation, because it's the bedrock of wealth management is some version of the 60-40 portfolio. Risk parity is a version of that. Risk parity is the ability or the way that you would trade the stock market and the bond market against each other. The risk parity concept was popularized by Bridgewater and Ray Dalio, right, where they trade stocks against bonds. That relationship has not been working. That strategy has not been working as well, too. This can become very problematic as well, because a lot of investors on both ends of the equation, bond investors that own bonds that will seek a little bit more risk or oomph in their portfolio, could use riskier assets because they believe there's a relationship between stocks and bonds. Stock investors that want to protect themselves could use the bond market as a natural hedge because they believe there's a relationship between the two. But if that relationship is gone and we're transitioning to an inflation mindset, for 2023, and we're in a no relationship environment, which is what I think we're in right now, it's going to take a lot of strategies Wall Street has. They're just not going to work properly.
I just did a video on the 1970s, and I didn't realize that. I found it fascinating that between 72 to 74, the S&P went down by like 60%, 6-0, while at the same time you had inflation, the CPI, up near 5, 6, 7%. So in that type of environment, you'd see interest rates going up and you'd see the stock market go down. In other words, you'd see bond prices go down and stock prices go down at the same time. So if you've got this risk parity portfolio that's nothing but bonds and stocks, that to your point, you've probably done extremely well since 1980, since we've been in a 40-year down cycle in interest rates, where the bond side of your portfolio over time gains makes money and capital gains, and then the stock side of your portfolio does the same. But what happens if we go to 1970s for the next 5 or 10 years, where both sides of the portfolio, the prices actually go down?
Yeah, that's going to be a shock for people, because what is the one thing on Wall Street, to show that you're pragmatic on Wall Street, what do? You're always bearish on bonds, because you always can say that the reason interest rates will go up is the economy's getting better. God bless America. So I'm bearish on bonds all the time. That is a way interest rates can go up, is that you just get very strong growth and it forces real rates higher and it forces nominal interest rates higher. But what we're talking about is the 70s way of rates going up. And that is that we get some kind of a stagflation, too much borrowing, too much inflation. Bond investors want to be properly compensated for it. And then you have interest rates go up. So I can't tell you how many times I talk to people in the institutional community, and they'll ask me, I've been a big bond bull until a few months ago, but since they've asked me about my outlook for interest rates, and I say I'm bearish on them, I think they're going to go up, and their reflex is, oh good, no, they're not going up because we're going to get strong real growth. They're going to go up because we're going to have some kind of inflation risk, and we're going to have some kind of a liquidity premium that's going to have to be put in them because you're going to be borrowing so much. That is going to be hard for people to kind of get their head around, I think, over time, is that why rates go up. They can go up for a good reason, right, but they can also go up for an inflation reason, too. And I want to emphasize again, This is the back cycle of this, because whether we get a vaccine or not, eventually we'll get herd immunity. Eventually we're going to, whether we get to 90% run through a bad recession, we're going to restart the economy. We're going to make an attempt to restructure the economy. I think that on the backside of this, we're going to find we produce less stuff. Aggregate supply goes down. We keep handing people money and say, go spend it. Keep boosting aggregate demand. And that's when we get the inflation. So it's not a story for this year. It's maybe a story for the second half of next year and as we move forward from there.
Yeah. All right. I've got about 45,000 more questions, Jim. I could spend all day here, but in the interest of time, we'll stop it right there. For the viewers who want to find out more about what you do, I know your website is fantastic. You've got a ton of research on there. I cannot recommend it enough. What's the website? Where can they go?
Yeah. Website's biancoresearch.com, at Bianco Research on Twitter. If you look me up on LinkedIn, those are the three platforms that I'm on. And I try to put out stuff to try and keep people apprised of what I'm doing. A lot of the stuff on the website is behind a paywall for paying customers, but there's a lot more stuff. I would start with Twitter. That's probably my basic public facing way that I go out there is by putting stuff on Twitter.
And I noticed on Jim, on your website right now, you've got a free trial offer, correct?
Yes, we always have a free trial offer. Our basic business model is we sell research for a living. We're always looking to for subscriptions. They come in one of two ways. Our institutional clients can pay us through the brokerage operation of Arbor Research through trading, or you could pay for it through a regular subscription level as well, too.
Yeah, but at the very least, I think they should go follow you on Twitter. If they like what they see, which I'm sure they will, then just go check out that free trial offer and take it from there. So, Jim, thank you again. I cannot wait to do it again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.